You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, March 16th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, writer, author, Eric Alterman. On Inequality and One City, Bill de Blasio and the New York Experiment, Year One. Also on the program today, tomorrow, it is the, I guess, I don't know how to phrase this. Maybe Netanyahu faces the voters. I wanted it to be more dramatic. But that's pretty dramatic. Also, FBI reportedly tracking the Black Lives Matter protests. Also on the program today, the human trafficking bill in the Senate. Even that can't pass, ladies and gentlemen. Republicans set to unveil their blueprint for the budget, and it literally does sound comedic when you read it. Unions gearing up against the TPP. We will talk about those demonic kids that a congressperson tried to exorcise and then returned after they found they didn't want to adopt demonic kids. And speaking of demonic, you know he's serious when Huckabee stops doing the diabetes, stop diabetes camp commercials he's been doing, promoting cinnamon. Yeah. All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, so I know critical thinking isn't Sam's strong suit, writes I'm not so sure listener James. But has he ever considered the fact that he's nearly 50 years old and still produces a podcast like an effing 12-year-old? Now, I'm not quite sure that I get what the point is here. If he's saying that it's embarrassing to produce a podcast at my age, which is not quite 50, but nearly, I guess, it's embarrassing to produce a podcast because 12-year-olds produce podcasts. Or if he's saying, hey, it sounds like a 12-year-old produces your podcast, why can't you get someone who's a little bit more mature and adept at what they're doing? Now, I should say, if that's if it's the latter, it really is a slam on Matt and Michael. And I apologize for that, guys. But, I mean, if you're saying doing a podcast is what a 12-year-old would do, that also seems just a little bit at odds with the facts. Are there really a lot of 12-year-olds doing podcasts? I wasn't aware of that. Does he honestly think that he's making a difference in the world? You know, that's a good question. That actually is a legitimate question. And many, many days I have serious reservations. Occasionally something happens where it's like, somebody tells me that they listen to the show and they work on another show, and so they covered this or that, or like, you know, when I'm at in a green room in MSNBC and I have a chance to argue with somebody who maybe ends up like changing their positions a little bit and they have a much bigger platform. Or so for the most part, I don't think that I'm making a huge difference in the world, but I think I'm like doing like maybe like, you know, tiny and, you know, every what I'm not the president of the United States. I'm not a world leader. I'm not even like a town leader. But okay, but that's a legitimate question. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm glad the only impact he has is brainwashing his kids with his dumbass liberal rhetoric. But still, yeah, that I'm definitely doing. But I mean, who wouldn't brainwash their own kids? Again, critical thinking isn't Sam's strong suit, but I'd like him to explain on his dumbass radio show why he believes that he knows what's best for over 300 million Americans. Let me correct you, James. I know what's best for about 225 million Americans. That's all I can handle. The pressure's just too great for 300 million. So I just try and keep it to 225 million. Like, a high minimum wage may work for many states, but is he honestly so effing arrogant that he believes every state, he capitalizes every, would benefit from that shite? Well, yeah, I definitely feel strongly that everyone working a minimum wage job, regardless of what state they're in, would benefit from it. Yes. I guess that's pretty rhetorical because I know that he really is, capitalizes again, that arrogant / stupid. But why didn't somebody tell him to take some time between dropping out of law school and hosting his dumb F radio show to think some shite through? Well, I took about 10, 15 years. Now, I got to admit, a lot of that time I was not thinking about the raising of the minimum wage, but, you know, it's not that complicated of an issue. And I will say that, you know, during that period of time, it had not fallen so far out of line with where it was in 1968 based on productivity and inflation. So to be fair to me, let me just make that point. But hey, one place he and I can probably agree, and let me just correct you here, James, it's not a place. It's maybe in one area or upon one issue that he and I can probably agree is that we all have the right to say whatever we want, no matter how effing stupid the shite he says is. And I agree that of you as well. In fact, I'm interested in listening to your podcast, unless, of course, you're older than 12, in which case you wouldn't ever make one. I just hope he teaches his kids to think for themselves rather than beating the shite out of them when they disagree with him. Like I'm assuming his parents did to him. Effing moron. Sincerely, a James King.
I like the touch of being like, you probably abused a child. Effing moron.
That's right. I do. That's right. That is basically the way it goes.
What a moron. You got beat as a kid. What an idiot.
I just go up to my 2-year-old son, Saul, and I'm like, quickly, at what age should there be a Medicare buy-in? Now, if he says, let's say, 55 or 58, or even if he says 45, you know what he gets? One of these. I go, that was a trick question. Because everybody should have the right to a Medicare buy-in. In fact, we should just go single payer. And then I'll go over to Myla, and I'll say, what percentage should we be collecting of our national income if we're traditional area with that relative to what we've done in the past? And if she says anything short of 89.5, like I give her a little wiggle room, you know what happens? Boom.
What's the little bit of wiggle room?
Well, it really should be 91%. So I give her a little, wiggle room. Because, of course, she's a lady. And the girls aren't expected to know math in the way that I expect my 2-year-old boy to. Folks, the reason why I read this is because I wanted to announce we're doing our Indiegogo campaign today, much to the annoyance of James King. So you can make sure that we continue to have very little effect and produce this show like a 12-year-old while I beat my children based upon their in an attempt to brainwash them to espouse liberal ideology. We have a link on our page. You just go to Google and I guess Google Indiegogo Majority Report. But we have a link right now at Majority FM. We're going to be doing this for 6 weeks. It's a lot to ask. I know we're asking you for the podcast awards. We're asking you to support the program. If you are a freebie listener and have, for whatever reason, have a psychological problem committing to the show, this is a great opportunity for you to go support the program as a one-off, our Indiegogo campaign. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Professor Eric Alterman. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program for the umpteenth time the distinguished professor of English and journalism at Brooklyn College, the CUNY and the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, the liberal media columnist for The Nation and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, The Nation Institute, and the World Policy Institute. Of course, the author of over, I guess it's 9 books now. Maybe it could even be more, some of which, of course, were New York Times bestsellers. The most recent is One City, Bill de Blasio, and the New York Experiment, Year One. Professor Eric Alterman. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Sammy.
And I got to say, first off, kudos on the Year One, because you're building a franchise on some level.
I don't think so. I think I'll hand off that franchise.
Oh, all right. Well,
for a price.
Of course, you got to leverage these things. All right. So, this is, you know, this the idea of, and I do mean like the idea of de Blasio seems to me to be really relevant these days, particularly with what's going on with Rahm Emanuel's race in Chicago, with the idea of. There needs on some level to be, or there's talk of like, you know, how is there a challenger to Hillary Clinton? The idea that there's this sort of other strain in the Democratic Party. And so, I mean, talk about just briefly, like de Blasio as part of a narrative.
Well, the narrative we've had, 40 years, a little bit over 40 years, of increasing inequality in the United States. The way you measure inequality is this one statistic called the Gini coefficient, and you want it to be zero if everybody's absolutely equal, if that's what you want. That's how you measure it anyway. And that number was going down from the beginning of the New Deal in 1932 through 1968, then it reversed itself, and it's been going up for the United States since 1968. People didn't start to notice the change until probably the late 70s. But since then, we've been aware of it, and it hasn't really affected public policy. I would say, this is just a judgment call, beginning with Occupy Wall Street, it forged itself into the public consciousness and became an issue. And the question is, what do you do about it? The Republican answer is you talk about it, but you make it worse. The Democratic answer, in most cases, has been, you talk about it and you do things that don't upset rich people and therefore only address the issue at its margins. Bill de Blasio is the first Democratic politician to say, we're going to tax rich people because inequality has gotten so out of hand that it's creating a city that we don't want to live in anymore, even if we ourselves are doing very well. And that message won him a electoral majority of nearly 50 points. So it's a very strong message in places like New York City and Seattle and Los Angeles and Chicago. We'll see how it translates to other kinds of places. But go ahead.
Well, what's interesting about that, too, is that the mayor in New York City has no, I guess, statutory authority to raise taxes. He doesn't have the ability to do that.
Yeah, that's it's a neat trick. I felt, and I've talked to de Blasio's consultants about this, I always felt that it was extraordinarily symbolic that he was saying, I'm going to tax rich people a few hundred dollars a year, people who make over $500,000 a year, a few hundred dollars a year, in order to pay for universal pre-K. Because, first of all, universal pre-K is really popular both with experts and with real people. And second of all, people knew, well, the reason it was important for symbolic reasons is that no Democrat had said it really in 30 years. No Democrat since Walter Mondale has said, I will raise taxes on wealthy people. That was 1984. So de Blasio crossed a line that liberals have been afraid to cross because the words tax and spend liberal were considered to be radioactive. Now, he did try and get the tax, and he couldn't get it, and I could have told him he wasn't going to get it if he had asked me, because Andrew Cuomo won't allow taxing of wealthy people, you know, even to end the apocalypse or prevent the apocalypse. But it's still nevertheless important because he showed that you can say this and without and win, as he did, in a place like this.
And I mean, so in many respects, I mean, you describe this as a paradigm shift, and that's the paradigm shift you're talking about.
No, that's actually not the paradigm shift I have in mind. Again, de Blasio was talking about a tiny little tax, and he didn't get it. The point is not the tax. The point is using the power of government, which is what de Blasio was really about. Like I said, the tax itself was just symbolic. What de Blasio was really about is using the power of government to deliver services to people who have been underserved by all government because rich people control the government, and getting those people to vote. So the Bloomberg administration took very good care of Russian billionaires and of generally of wealthy people, even semi-wealthy people who just can afford to eat in nice restaurants. So let's say the Bloomberg administration took very good care of the 5% and of the media and was very popular with both. De Blasio is actually directing his policies towards really poor people. Now, he's taking care of the whole city. He can't help the poor people unless he first makes sure that the trains are running on time and the streets are safe and clean, et cetera, et cetera. You do all the things that are called housekeeping. But if you do that effectively, then people are willing to open up their hearts and wallets a little bit and help people who really need help. And to me, the most amazing thing about this administration is how much energy it puts into helping people who traditionally have had not only had no power, but have never even really voted very much.
I mean, and you know, we're of course putting aside the failure to plow on the Upper East Side. Is that you know? I'm joking, of course.
But yeah, we could go into all that again if you want, but I think maybe.
So let me get more clear on this paradigm shift. So is it is one that is also it is about how he's governing, or it's about the governing coalition that he developed, or the electoral coalition?
No, I think the governing coalition that he developed is unique to New York, because New York has all of these activist groups and also a much higher concentration of union workers than almost any place else. The average unionization in the country, including public unions, is about 11%, but in New York it's about 30%. And plus we have, because it's New York and we have all these immigrant groups and we have this history of social activism and even our Republicans are pretty liberal, you can do a lot more in New York with a coalition than, it's easier to form such a coalition in this city than in almost any other city. But the paradigm shift, the new metropolitan model that I'm talking about that de Blasio, I believe, is pioneering, is saying there are all these people, particularly Latino voters, but who traditionally have voted at very low rates, but there are all these people who have felt themselves ignored by the system and traditionally don't vote very much. Rich people vote a lot more than poor people. Middle-class people vote better than poor people. And de Blasio is delivering services to these people. He's delivering universal pre-K. He's vastly increasing the number of after-school spots. He's raising the minimum wage. He's giving sick leave. He's getting behind the fast food workers. He's completely transformed the welfare agency, New York City Welfare Agency. And he's saying that in a city where you can actually deliver services, where politics doesn't take place in the media and in symbols, we can actually deliver services. If you deliver those services that affect enough people's lives, they will vote for you, and government will and democracy will become meaningful in a way that it isn't in national politics. I personally was shocked to see it. I've been so cynically transformed by my my observation of national politics in the past that I had forgotten that governments can actually help people.
Yeah, I mean, well, now do we need to wait and see if he brings out those voters? I mean, if he is in fact rewarded by those voters, or we, you know, that part of it. And
I think that's a big question. I think that's a big question. When I have friends who worked very hard on the Obamacare, and they're all upset that all this effort went into creating this program that has helped tens of millions of people, and yet there's no political payoff for it. In fact, it's a large net negative, apparently. And that's because, you know, when we talk about Obamacare, there's all these different forces in the national media and in national politics that are coloring people's perceptions of it and confusing people on purpose about what's happening and what their relationship to it is. But in a metropolitan government, the relationship is much more direct. And so everybody knows who's providing universal pre-K. Everybody knows who's making sure that sick leave is taken care of. There's no middleman. There's no Fox News to confuse the point. The right-wing media is much weaker in New York City than it is at a national level. So the question is will these people join in the political process in a way that in the past they haven't? I mean, this is actually, if you think about it, this is what happened at the turn of the 20th century, 115 years ago, when all these immigrant groups bought into local politics. And particularly on the Lower East Side, the Jews, who at the time were the largest group in all of New York City, they were more Eastern European Jews than they were like plain old white people in New York City in those days. They went from being socialists outside of the system into the Democratic Party as part of the system because they were getting the services they need to move from being proletarians into the middle class. And that's what de Blasio is trying to do on a smaller level, but nevertheless with the same idea. He's saying, here's what government can do for you, and we're in this together, and that means I need your vote if you want it to continue. And we won't know how well it works. But I'm for once in my life, optimistic about it.
Let's talk about some of the actual things, and then I want to sort of go back to that sort of political aspect, because I think in that dynamic where people understand that that where they attribute these services directly to de Blasio, in some ways Cuomo is helping him because he's providing some very stark contrast. But before we head there, let's talk about what he has actually done. Talk about what you write about the welfare agency. I didn't know any of this stuff, and it is it was a pretty bold move just in terms of his appointment.
Yeah, well, he. The previous head of the welfare agency under Bloomberg, I can't remember people's names, I'll have to look them up while I'm talking, was a guy who then went on to become a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. So he's a very right-wing guy. And he believed all this stuff about if you help people too much, they won't want to work and they'll be dependent on the system and forget about it. And that's the sort of typical ideology that has come out of the Reagan era. Mr. Banks, who de Blasio appointed to replace him, first of all, it's important to know that de Blasio didn't have any relationship with this guy. He's appointing people who are recommended to him as the best people for the job, and he's not picking cronies. There are almost no cronies at all in this administration. Again, that's odd to me. Anyway, Mr. Banks was the head of his name is Stephen Banks. He spent the past 30 years in the Legal Aid Society, the past 10 of it as the head of the Legal Aid Society, suing New York City on behalf of the clients of the welfare agency, suing the city, saying you're not serving the people who are, you know, in domestic violence situations, the homeless, people who are coming out of prison and need to be reintegrated into the workforce, people who need job training. He's been suing the city, and now he's running it. If you're a right winger, you would say the fox is guarding the chicken coop, but it's actually a chicken is guarding the chicken coop. Not a chicken, but someone who's like head of the chicken.
An advocate for the chickens.
Yeah, an advocate for the chickens. And this guy came in, Mr. Banks, and within 6 weeks, he turned the place upside down. He said, we're no longer serving ourselves and our ideology and our bureaucracy. We're serving our actual clients. And he changed all the rules that were possible to change, and they keep changing. But just the first memo he issued was like 6 pages. Each sentence was, we're not doing this anymore, we're doing the opposite. We're not doing this anymore, we're doing the opposite. And all of it was directed at providing services to roughly 3 million people who, again, have had very little representation or voice in our politics. You never hear about them. And I was really, that really impressed me. And when I talked to Banks and also some of the other people's administration, I kept saying, you know, how are you going to make your case in the media? You know, the media doesn't care. These people don't know anyone on the op-ed pages, et cetera. And he said, you know, we're just going to do our job here and hope that it turns out well. And again, that's just not how you do national politics. And to me, that represents a kind of paradigm shift.
Yeah, I mean, do we have a sense? I mean, I've seen very little. And to be fair, I don't spend an inordinate amount of energy following up on local politics. But I mean, have we seen any type of response? I mean, do we have a sense of how it's going? I mean, do we have any sense of within the advocacy, I guess, world for people who would be dealing with the New York Welfare Agency? Is there a sense that things are going well?
I think that there is a sense of shared goals and means in the advocacy world on this issue. On some issues, there's some impatience with de Blasio. By and large, however, I feel that the advocates have, there's been more attention paid to certain issues rather than other issues. Certain issues have come first. Housing, first he did education, now he's doing housing. He hasn't gotten to labor rights yet. When I interviewed him, he told me he's going to get to labor rights. He hasn't done it yet. That's like down the road. I think the advocacy community, having spent 20 years fighting Giuliani and Bloomberg, are invested in him and are willing to be patient on most things. And they see good faith efforts, particularly in appointments like this. It's their people. It's people who've been, you know, de Blasio, another really interesting thing about him is that he sees himself as part of a movement, as part of a progressive movement. And part of that, part of his job, therefore, is to bring other people from that movement into city government and train them on how to be effective bureaucrats. So a lot of the people he's appointed are people who are in training to, on the one hand, run a city government, but on the other hand, address issues of inequality wherever you find them. The most interesting thing that de Blasio has done, and New York Post actually wrote an editorial calling this complete, using the word crazy. Really a funny editorial. But anyway, the most interesting thing he's done is that he has instructed every single city agency to include in their semi-annual report of how things are going, I think it's called the Mayor's Management Report, what that agency is doing to address the problem of inequality. So no matter what the job of the city agency is doing, even things you wouldn't think had anything to do with inequality, he wants them to find ways to address this problem. And that's a real sea change. And again, it's not something that the press is really all that interested in. So these things can be happening under the radar, and you and I, before I decided to write this book, wouldn't have much idea about it.
Right.
But, you know, another interesting thing, when I talk to his strategists, is that the press is not what it used to be. The Daily News and the New York Post used to have circulations of nearly, the Daily News had nearly 1 million, and the Post had over 500,000. They have a fraction of that now. So many more people are getting their news in so many different ways that the things that we think matter, that the particularly the elite media think matter, those aren't so important. All of these hysterical editorials about the police that you read in the news and the Post
right.
did not have much effect on people. The people were getting their own information. And so when you saw those surveys about de Blasio and the police and Lynch and so forth, de Blasio was actually considered to be doing a pretty good job. You would never know that, never, ever know that, if you read the Daily News or the New York Post.
If I remember correctly, I don't know if it was de Blasio endorsed by the New York Times in his race.
De Blasio was not endorsed in the Democratic primary by any of the newspapers.
Right.
All three of them endorsed Christine Quinn. Thank you for bringing that up. That is an unimaginable thing 10 years ago. First of all, you should win a Democratic primary in a local New York race if you get the Times endorsement, period. That's the way it's always been. But for someone to get all three endorsements and to not even reach 20%, and for somebody to reach 40% approximately and get no endorsements, that really says something about the decrease in power of the New York, of the mainstream media.
Another
way to look at it, by the way, is when I was growing up in New York, there were these columnists in New York who people looked to as kind of their voices and their surrogates, people like Murray Kempton and Sid Sandberg and Jimmy Breslin and Pete Hamill and who am I forgetting? Jack Newfield in the Village Voice. There's nobody you can think of like that anymore. There's not
right.
a single name that people share in this way. The same way we all used to share Johnny Carson. I don't know if you're old enough to share Johnny Carson with me, Sammy.
Well,
but,
I'm aware of him.
Okay.
Yes, no, of course.
The same way we all used to share Johnny Carson, urban people used to share columnists. In San Francisco, you had Herb Kahn, and in Chicago, you had Mike Royko. That era is gone, and now you know we share Facebook and Twitter, and so it's harder to reach people. But there's also much less of a gatekeeper function on the part of the mainstream media, and it's even truer in metropolitan politics than it is in national politics, because in national politics, it's at least something you can do. You can feel like you're doing something if you're winning the media battle, whereas if you're because you can't reach actual people from the presidency. But as a mayor can reach actual people, and that's where de Blasio was putting his efforts.
I want to talk just a little bit more about the inequality and how it manifests itself in different departments that you wouldn't necessarily assume have anything to do with inequality. And I know you have spent a lot of time studying inequality, and that there was, you know, some things that surprised you about just how much it impacts, how widely. I'm thinking about pregnant women here, that one piece of inequality that you found about how it implicates pregnancy even.
I got it, Sammy. That was a shocker to me, the example that you and I talked about privately not too long ago, where I found out that what's called spatial inequality, where people live in isolated areas that are not well served by any kind of services and have to travel great distances to get every little thing that they need, be it medical, be it food, be it bureaucratic, be it jobs, that this increases the stress that people carry around. And if you're pregnant and your stress level increases, then it cuts off the blood flow to the brain of the infant you're carrying. So when that baby is born, he or she is born with a smaller brain than a child whose mother did not experience that level of stress. So from the minute that child is born, he or she is suffering from the effects of economic inequality. And even if that child mother wins the lottery the next day and gets $1 million, he or she is always going to be at a disadvantage. And that's just one tiny little thing. There's countless, infinite numbers of effects like that. I'm just looking now. I found, I'm scrolling through the book, and I found that what I was talking about earlier, there's something called the Mayor's Management Report. And de Blasio, he had a big retreat. His deputy mayor, a man named Anthony Shores, ran the retreat, and he instructed every single person, all the top managers in the city government, to think of ways they could address inequality, and they did role-playing and stuff across all agencies. And the first report, which came out, there's now been a second one, but the first one that came out in September 2014 included a 27-page focus on equity statement that are, that asked each agency to articulate how they were going to address inequality. So the EPA, for instance, you're asking me about ways people don't think about it, they created a home water assistance program to provide an annual water bill credit to low-income homeowners. The Department of Consumer Affairs noted that it had informed 400,000 businesses and millions of residents of the city's paid sick leave law. And the Office of Emergency Management reported the initiation of a wide range of programs to mitigate the impact of Sandy on communities so they can return more quickly to prior conditions. And then some of them weren't really ready. Like the, one of the agencies, what they did was they translated their regulations into like 21 different languages because there's a language issue with regard to inequality, and they're just getting started. But I found this really impressive because, like you and like me, before I wrote this book, most people will never hear about these things. And although most people, like I said, de Blasio was elected because even upper middle class people and some very wealthy people are nervous about the level of inequality in this city and how well tended the super wealthy are compared to everybody else, that most of those people would be satisfied that something is being done. But this administration is really going the extra distance to actually serve the people at the bottom. It's very complicated to reach these people. When I was talking to the Deputy Mayor Burry about the setting up of the pre-K program, the city added 54,000 spots for four-year-olds. Part of the biggest challenge was just reaching people and letting them know that this program was available if they had a four-year-old and how to get into it, because most people are not, you know, they're not part of the system.
And there was not a lot of lead time for that either.
Yeah, it's actually an amazing, the pre-K thing is an amazing achievement. The Daily News actually wrote an entire editorial of apology because of how cynical they had been about this as a campaign issue and the fact that it came to being. And the New York Times also wrote a semi-apology because when de Blasio first went to Albany to try and get money for this, since it was going to be a fight, you know, he still wanted the tax at that point, and Cuomo said, okay, here's a year's funding, go away, the New York Times said, take the money and run. And de Blasio said, no, I need a steady stream of funding. And he didn't quite get that, but he got 3 years of funding. And if you've got a program that is working well for 3 years for hundreds of thousands of people, then it's going to be very hard to get rid of it. And de Blasio really did, his people really did work. I've never seen city government operate so, I've never seen government operate so effectively in my life. They worked really hard to make sure that whatever problems they have would be mitigated. And, I mean, there were going to be problems, but they really haven't been serious. They've really been shocking. I thought it would be much worse. I thought it would be more like the rollout of Obamacare, which is what we kind of expect from government now.
You know, what fascinates me, you've touched on this, but I just want to expand a little bit, is that when he forces every agency in the city to contemplate inequality, what that does is, I mean, he's already, and you said this about sort of creating, bringing people in from the movement and making them part of the bureaucracy. This is indelible. In other words, people who are going to be working at this agency, regardless of who's the next mayor, there's going to be a culture in these agencies to be contemplating these things and actually reorienting their thinking that their job is to provide services and to go even further in making sure that it's hitting everybody it can.
Yeah, well, that's what Ronald Reagan did in 1980, and it did transform our government and transform our conversation. And that's the job of a movement. They had a movement back then, and liberals and progressives don't really have much of a movement. We have a lot of little movements. And de Blasio is trying to be a focal point and a uniting force for all of these movements, and also a kind of taming force to make them more pragmatic about what can be achieved. And it's not a pretty thing, but So far, again, I'm impressed. He's much more ambitious than I would have imagined someone being in that role. You know, again, if you look at Obama, I'm one of the people who had very high hopes for Obama and has been very disappointed. I understand all of the problems. I wrote a book about that, which I think he had me on for. Thank you very much. But even so, I think Obama's position was, okay, this is the best we can do. Let's take whatever deal we can. Whereas de Blasio is not saying this is the best we can do. De Blasio is saying, let's get the people who believe in this on our side and let's fight for it, and then let's see what's the best we can do.
And that
we haven't seen in a government, in an American government, since the New Deal.
Give us a sense of what you think he's done poorly up to this point. Because I think it ties in. We can also touch upon what who Andrew Cuomo is and what role he's playing. And like I say, I think to a certain extent, sometimes he helps because he's just providing this foil for de Blasio. But talk about, what you think that de Blasio has done poorly up to this point.
Well, there's no question that he and his staff was very naive in going into the fight over charter schools with Cuomo. De Blasio won the battle for pre-K, and again, rolled it out beautifully eventually. But at the same time, he was stabbed in the back by Cuomo over this charter school issue. Do you want me to go into all the details of that?
Well, yeah. I mean, we've talked about it on this program, and so I think it's worthwhile doing that. I think also, you know, in light of de Blasio coming back and then having to sort of be as important as anybody about getting the Working Families Party endorsement for Cuomo, I think there's something telling about that dynamic.
Okay. Well, we'll get into the weeds then. So, 1.1 million students are in the New York City public schools. 1.5 million are in New York City going to school. The other 20% go to private schools. 4% of the larger number are in charter schools. 6% of public school students are in charter schools. The charter school movement is funded largely by hedge fund managers. In the last election, 2014, the single largest contributor to Albany politicians were charter school funders, even bigger than the real estate industry, which is amazing.
Amazing.
New York City politics. Now, when the charter school issue came up, the city has to give space to the charter schools and sometimes displace regular schools. And the teachers' union don't like charter schools because they have no control over them and they're not part of them. And they're very iffy in terms of how well-run they are because there's so little supervision. So there's a woman named Eva Moskowitz who runs a corporation called Success Academies that runs a bunch of charter schools. She is incredibly well-funded by these hedge fund managers. She's got a PAC that gives out millions and millions of dollars. She pays herself approximately $500,000 a year. And she wanted 17 new charter schools in the last round. De Blasio approved 14 of them, but not 3 of them. And let me check and say, I'm not 100% sure all 17 were hers, but there were 17 new charter school proposals in front of de Blasio. He approved 14 of them, not 3 of them. 3 of them were Eva Moskowitz's schools. And there were problems with all 3, including displacing kids who were in school and would have to find another place to go to school. It seemed like he was being incredibly generous in that program because he had run against charter schools in the campaign. He ran as very critical of them, and he had been attacked by the movement. Nevertheless, because he didn't give them everything they wanted, Cuomo conspired with Moskowitz and her funders to create this enormous rally on a school day. They pulled the kids out of school on a school day, and on a day when de Blasio went to go lobby for pre-K, he was met by thousands and thousands of school kids at this rally that it turned out that Cuomo had helped to organize to rally for these charter schools. And the media were entirely on the side of the charter schools, not the New York Times so much, but definitely the tabloid media. And he ended up looking like an idiot, and he had to give in. And since then, he's learned that he can't trust Andrew Cuomo at all, but he has to pretend to be his best friend because Cuomo holds the purse strings
right
for everything New York City does. So I'm actually quite impressed. It's one reason I am not the mayor of New York City, and neither are you, because he really has to kiss Cuomo's ass in public as Cuomo twists knives in his back in private. And that's the best thing for New York City. And the Working Families Party, he secured the nomination for Cuomo, and then Cuomo stabbed them in the back. And those people are pissed off about that, too. But I think he did the right thing. Cuomo was going to win that election anyway, and it's very important that he owes de Blasio favors, that he does not appear that he's not punishing the city because he doesn't like what de Blasio is doing. If he wants to, you know, he needs to, de Blasio has no choice but to stay on Andrew Cuomo's good side no matter what Cuomo does, because he just has no power over him, and Cuomo holds all the power.
So you're suggesting that de Blasio, unlike you or I, in a situation where we might be offended, he's done a good job of making sure that doesn't in any way impede his agenda.
Yeah, I'm not saying whether he is offended or not. I'm saying he's keeping his offense to himself, and he's allowing himself to be made to look foolish on certain occasions because he's willing to make that sacrifice so that the governor does not take out any more anger on the city than is absolutely necessary.
What's also interesting, there was a story, and I'm not sure if you're aware of this or not, but there was a story, I guess it was last week in the Times, by Michael Grinbaum, about the Mayor de Blasio soliciting donations for, I guess, allied nonprofit that will support some of his agenda. In other words, he realizes he went into a buzzsaw with that whole charter thing. And you're talking about funders like Ken Langone and other big hedge funders. So he needs some cash. So it sounds like he's at the very least bulking up his political operation now with a greater understanding of just like what's involved in some of these fights so that he could call on outside support.
Well, he raised money for the pre-K fight also. He did this. He's done this in the past. But, yes, he very much sees himself as the leader of a coalition of outside groups, and he wants to bring to bear the power of those outside groups on the traditional politicians because that's what the other side does. I mean, like I said, the two largest contributors to Albany politicians where the purse strings are held are charter schools as of this year and the real estate industry. And the real estate, you know, housing is the second most important issue to him after education. And now that, you know, education has kind of succeeded, he's turned to housing, and he needs to find his support there.
What is it? That was going to be my next and just about final question. Is it what's next for
him? I'm not Rick Pilson. I'll stay here as long as you want.
Oh, well.
let me just tell my cook to hold on.
Wow.
I wouldn't want it to be interrupted. Fired.
There we go. And I have to say, I should tell longtime listeners of this program who may be even a little disappointed, it does not appear that you're eating lunch at this time.
No, I had my cook is waiting. He's giving me dirty looks. He's got the Chateaubriand on simmer.
I was going to say that it's very rare, particularly this time of day, to have Eric Alterman on.
I know. That was kind of cruel of you to have it at noon. But anyway, go ahead.
So what's next for him? Like, if we're going to judge him, if you're not going to do year two or year three, how do we judge what he should have accomplished, and what does he plan to accomplish going forward?
Well, this ebook, we should tell people how to get the book, right? Because you've got to order it You can either order it from Amazon or you can order it from Nation eBooks.
Okay, and we have a link, I think, to both on majority.fm.
This book focuses on four areas: education, housing, economic development, and criminal justice. And each one has different measurements that you can, judge him on the basis of. What I think is most interesting, again, you can't. Earlier I mentioned the Gini coefficient, and everybody involved in administration says we're not going to get any movement in the Gini coefficient. That's beyond the ability of city government. But we can use the power of this government to help an awful lot of people. It's a very big and powerful government. Something like the estimate they gave me is something like 20% of people in New York City have some economic relationship to the city government.
Hmm.
So, for instance, housing. There's this 421 program where builders get an enormous tax break of condos if they set aside some housing for so-called affordable housing. Affordable housing is defined as affordable to people who make between $35,000 and $100,000 a year. So Michael Bloomberg had a very strict 80-20 rule on that. If you built 20% of your housing in that affordable category, 80% of your housing, you could charge whatever you want.
And you got to go into a poor door if you're one of the poors.
That's another issue. And it's complicated. But anyway, de Blasio has refused to accept that 80-20 split. What he's after, although he's doing this episodically, what he's after, by and large, is 27%. So he's increasing the number of affordable housing units in this demand by over 30%, over a third. And he's playing hardball with the city's zoning powers and the real estate barons to get this larger number. And he's done this twice. He's had two big fights where the developer threatened to pull out if he didn't go back to their original agreement that Bloomberg's administration had negotiated. And both times he's won. Both times he's given in at the last minute. So the thing about this is that in 4 years you could say, did de Blasio solve the housing crisis? No. It's insoluble. It's a permanent crisis, just like the crisis of homelessness is permanent, just like the crisis of criminal justice in this city is permanent, just like the problems of education in this city are permanent. But he's using the power of government to help as many people as he can without screwing up the system. So the real estate industry, they would prefer that they didn't have to build these apartments. But actually, they say, okay, this is reasonable. We can make a lot of money with this. We understand that things were better for us under the last guy, but this is who the city's chosen, and he's a reasonable person. De Blasio is not. He's not a fidelista. He's not
right.
The way he's portrayed on Fox News and New York Post. He is, as one of his critics once said, more Machiavelli than Marx. So He's got this housing plan, which was developed by his deputy mayor, Alicia Glenn, who's a former Goldman Sachs analyst, or whatever she was there. And it's very demanding, given the power structure of New York City, given how powerful the real estate industry is. But it's realistic, and it's possible. And that's what he's shooting for. He's shooting for the best deal for the most people that is possible. He's incredibly pragmatic. He doesn't have a lot of charisma, I don't think. I don't get the sense that people feel invested in him personally. But he sees himself as a catalyst for a movement, much like his model is Fiorello LaGuardia, who, by the way, is the mayor who was most instrumental in bringing in all the outside groups into city government, Italians and Jews in particular.
On the real estate front, how much is his perspective on this sort of formed by, I know he was supportive of the Barclay Center and the whole Atlantic Yards thing, which was very controversial in Brooklyn, and they have yet to really bring in the affordable housing part of the equation. Do you have a sense of how that sat with him, and was that just more of his pragmatism?
I don't know how that sat with him. I didn't ask him about that. But I do think that having done that is part of what made the real estate business okay with him, like not fearful of him and not try and give a lot of money under the table to try and destroy him. The fact that he played ball with them on that, which you know, they got a very sweet deal on. And he's done other things where he's supported development that had no affordable housing at all in it in the past, not as mayor. So he's always been pro-development. And he's using those credentials to try and bring more affordable housing. If he were seen, you know, someone who was seen as the Al Sharpton of development wouldn't get anything done. Right? Mm-hmm. So he's definitely seen as someone that these very powerful economic forces can work with. And otherwise, you know, you couldn't be mayor of the city without that, because that's who runs the city.
Well, Eric Alterman, the book is Inequality in One City, the New York Experiment, Bill de Blasio and the New York Experiment, Year One. We have links to that at majority.fm. I really recommend the book because it is fascinating to see this happening in the biggest city in the country. And the question is, you know, how much of that narrative, when de Blasio won, there was this big narrative, right? This is sort of like the Warren de Blasio. It sort of implied some type of wave, and we'll see if this holds too in Chicago, and some similar things happening maybe in Boston and L.A. It'll be interesting to see if this is the bellwether and this becomes sort of a model.
That's the conclusion of my book. I'm glad you reached the end of it there.
There you go, buddy. See how I brought that home?
Yeah. All right.
Professor Eric Alterman, thank you so much for your time today.
Always a pleasure, as I said. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. There it is, folks. I hope that's interesting for people outside of New York. It certainly should be. I mean, the idea of, you know, and you got to take this. I mean, obviously, Bill de Blasio is not going to be doing. He's not a Fidelista, and maybe we're not at a point where we could elect a Fidelista to the mayorality of New York. But this idea of, and this is why, to a certain extent, people were so upset about the failure of President Obama to make appointments early in his administration. You know, there's a massive bureaucracy, certainly in the federal government, but in New York City government. And these bureaucrats who were there, they're going to be there for years to come. They're going to certainly be there longer than Bill de Blasio. And this is also, I mean, this dynamic applies to a lot of different things. And how these young bureaucrats, the ones who don't even run the agency, I'm talking about the people who might ultimately run the agency, it might end up being the senior leadership of these agencies, how they are trained, what they learn to do, how they learn to do their job becomes sort of the way the job is done. And I mean, I've heard people talk about this in the context of teachers. Like, we have a generation of teachers now who largely aren't even aware of just how much of their autonomy they have lost, or the position of teachers has lost, because of the testing regimes. And it creates a failure of imagining what they could be doing. And also, I think it makes the job, apparently, the numbers of people who are starting to sign up to become a teacher is dropping precipitously. And there's no wonder, because they get there and they find, wow, there's no opportunity for me to be a professional in any way. I just have to be a cog. A total cog in this machine. Like, I don't even have the ability to sort of to design how I relate to each child. And so this is how you change institutions. And that's the thing that that Reagan did and Bush did to a certain extent, too, is just populate these agencies with people whose perspective was fundamentally the best thing they can do for their agencies to make sure that they're spending less and less. And then you have also a certain amount of, you know, sort of quasi-corruption of, well, as long as we're servicing, I would say corruption, as long as we're servicing the primary industry that we're supposed to be regulating, that's our job. We're not supposed to be preventing industries from sort of taking too large of a piece of the pie of worker safety and consumer rights. We're just supposed to be enhancing their ability to create profit. That was a fundamental shift. And I don't know if Obama achieved that, frankly. But the value of, you know, there being major metropolitan areas where that is happening is those people go on to populate the federal agencies. So, all right, we're going to take a quick break. Enter into the fun half of the program. Folks, we need your memberships. I mean, I know many of you who listen to the program, you'd certainly be upset if it went away. You certainly want to support it in some fashion. Some of you are afraid to make, maybe you have commitment issues. Maybe it's time for you to grow up a little bit, but I'm not going to get into that. But if you're really commitment phobic, head over to our Indiegogo page. Help us out. It's like a one night stand, or maybe you could have one of those things where it's like, we're just going to spend the week together, or maybe, you know, we'll do this for 2 or 3 weeks.
See how it goes.
Just give me my space. Let's just Tuesdays and Thursdays are for you.
Do you have like a bug on my phone?
What's
that? My apartment or something, Sam?
Michael Brooks' apartment? Michael just wants to make it clear. It's like you want to hang out with other shows? I encourage you. Listen
to the Young Turks.
Yeah.
Listen to any, check them out. Watch Secular Talk.
That's right. No, those shows are great, and we spent some time with them.
Yeah, they're all great.
But, you know, Tuesdays and Thursdays are for us, and, you know, it may be, you know, and then, you know, we'll see how drunk I get on Friday night at the wine bar. And if I have too much Fumé Blanc, then
sometimes when you fuse a Kundalini yoga class with some drinking, you get very high energy on a Friday night.
For Michael Brooks, it's not just about drunk dialing. It's if he had too much hot yoga that day.
Yeah, it's Kundalini dialing.
Yeah, it's like
right.
I didn't realize. But if you are more mature, let's say like someone like Matt, and you're ready to enter into, you know, some type of commitment, like, no, listen, none of this is cut in stone, right? You know that, Matt. None of this is set in stone.
But don't worry, buddy. There's hope for you, too.
You can become a member. Also, for those of you who are just completely, like, we don't even want to set Tuesdays and Thursdays. For those of you who are like Michael Brooks, like when he's taking a trip to wherever, to Turkey, whatever it is. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Or use our Amazon link. You're already buying the stuff from Amazon anyways. If you buy that crap from Amazon, the very least you can do, Michael, is to go to MajorityReportKickback.com and click on the link and just buy through there. All right?
Oh, yeah, I can do that. I can do that. That's good.
Give me some space,
but I'll get that done.
My backpack, and I'm just blowing through. I don't even know tomorrow, Ankara. I have no idea. I have no idea. I just spin the wheel. I just got an open-ended ticket. So if I have time to spend time with you, I'll do it. If I can hang, I just all I need is just a yoga class. I just got my mat with me and good bottle of good bottle of Chablis.
Chablis. Oh, my God.
And I'll be fine.
Is Chablis a white?
All right. Oh, no. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I don't think so.
Nice try. All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half. The number 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of the program, of course, you can IM me via the app, which is free. So, oh, and you should also check out Kyle has developed an app called, he works for this company, Drizzly, Drizly. And you get booze delivered.
But you won't feel so ambiguous about spending money on that, will you?
Right. So it's Drizzly. Check it out. It's pretty cool. You can schedule the delivery. And by law, apparently, liquor stores can't add. I think there's a delivery charge, but they can't add price to it. Add cost. All right, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM through your instant message client, or again, get the app at majorityapp.com. You can IM me. It's free. It's totally free. I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know what I was thinking. That reminds me, like, I think at one point I thought, like, oh, I'll make money off of this. It didn't really occur to me, like, how I would do that. But it's free. And free of ads. Maybe that's what I got to start doing, larding it up with ads. All right, we'll see you in the fun half.